Imagine a heavily armed militia just, you know, marching into a peaceful, totally unsuspecting town.
Yeah.
They steal all their most prized possessions, and then they basically bribe a corrupt local official to bless the entire operation.
Right, which sounds totally like a movie.
Yeah, it sounds like the plot of some modern cartel thriller or something. But imagine this, it isn't. It's actually a story from the Bible.
Which is wild.
It is wild, and even wilder. Today, we're doing a deep dive into the source material to look at how a master public speaker uses this, like, 3,000-year-old heist to teach us how to hold an audience in the palm of our hands.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating text because it operates on two completely different yet totally intersecting levels.
Exactly.
We're diving into a transcript from Dr. Stephen D. Mathewson. It's from his series on preaching Old Testament narratives, specifically his 10th session.
Right, so we are essentially getting a two-for-one experience in this deep dive. On one level, Mathewson is providing this really cool meta commentary on his own public speaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how to pace a narrative, how to withhold information for maximum impact, and just the sheer power of making your audience work for the meaning.
Right. He's teaching you how to tell a story while telling a story.
Yes. And on the other level, the story he actually uses to demonstrate this is from chapters 17 and 18 of the book of Judges. And it is a dark, bizarre tale. I mean, we're talking grand larceny, unauthorized spy missions, and just, you know, profound societal collapse.
Oh, absolutely. And Mathewson uses this incredibly chaotic text to prove a foundational point about storytelling and homiletics, which, you know, is the formal art of preaching.
Right.
He really demonstrates that ancient texts aren't just these dusty historical records, right? When you unpack them correctly, they function as these high-definition mirrors reflecting human nature.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
And human nature, especially regarding what we value, what we obsess over, and ultimately worship, it remains remarkably unchanged.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the way Mathewson starts his analysis is just brilliant. He completely ignores the historical timeline of the Book of Judges right at the outset.
Yeah, he just skips right past it.
Right. Instead, he drops this quote from the 16th century theologian John Calvin, and the quote is, "The human heart is a perpetual factory of idols."
A factory. Yeah.
That implies something industrial, you know, something relentless and completely automatic. It's just churning out substitutes for God on a conveyor belt.
It really frames the entire discussion perfectly because to a modern listener, the word idol almost always conjures up images of primitive societies, right?
Yeah.
Like bowing down to golden statues or carved stones.
Exactly. It feels utterly disconnected from our 21st century reality. Like, I don't have a golden calf in my living room.
Right, right. So Mathewson knows he has to redefine idolatry for his audience before the story will actually land. An idol, in the context of this deep dive, is, it's anything we look to for our ultimate security and our ultimate significance. It's basically anything that takes the central governing place in our lives.
And to bring that into the modern era, Mathewson actually quotes a country song, which I loved.
Oh, yeah, the Casey Musgraves one?
Yeah, Merry Go Round. There's this lyric that goes, "Mama's hooked on Mary Kay, brother's hooked on Mary Jane, daddy's hooked on Mary two doors down."
Such a great line.
It is, because it highlights this whole spectrum of obsession. Mm-hmm. You have the obviously destructive elements, right, like addiction to marijuana or infidelity.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have Mama's Hooked on Mary Kay, which is literally just selling cosmetics.
Right. Selling cosmetics, having a hobby, building a career there is absolutely nothing inherently malicious about any of those things.
Exactly.
But Mathewson is making this crucial point that even mundane, culturally celebrated pursuits become destructive idols when they are elevated to a place of ultimate reverence.
Oh, for sure.
And he even turns the lens on himself, which is interesting. He mentions looking at a photo of his grandkids on his mantle or a picture of himself fly fishing in Montana.
Just normal, beautiful gifts.
Exactly. Beautiful gifts. Yet he admits that if he relies on his family or his hobbies for his fundamental sense of worth, they mutate into idols. He even points to the biblical book of Colossians, chapter 3, verse 5, which explicitly equates greed with idolatry.
Wow.
Yeah, greed is just the relentless pursuit of security through accumulation.
You know, it reminds me of using a butter knife as a screwdriver.
Oh, I like that. How so?
Well, a butter knife is a perfectly good tool. It does exactly what it's designed to do, right? Spread butter on toast. But the second you try to use it to unscrew a stubborn, rusted screw, you completely ruin the knife.
Oh, yeah. You strip the screw, bend the knife.
Exactly, and you probably cut your hand in the process. You're asking the tool to bear a weight and perform a function it was never structurally designed for.
That's a great analogy.
And that's what happens when we take a good career or a relationship or even our kids and turn them into ultimate God things. We just crush them under the weight of our own expectations.
And when that blade snaps, you are left with a broken tool and a totally shattered sense of stability. Yeah, psychologically, that is the exact danger Matthewson is warning against. If idolatry is this subtle, like a factory, running quietly in the background of our individual minds, the natural question is, what happens when a whole society lets that factory run completely unchecked?
Right. What does a culture look like when literally everyone is using butter knives as screwdrivers?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the actual narrative from the book of Judges. So chapter 17 opens with a man named Micah, who lives in the hill country of Ephraim.
And Micah's name, ironically, translates to "who is like Yahweh."
Which is so funny because, as the text reveals in the very first sentence, Micah is nothing like Yahweh.
Not at all. He casually confesses to his own mother that he is the one who stole 1,100 shekels of silver from her.
Right. Just massive, devastating theft from his own family.
It's wild.
Yeah.
But his mother's reaction introduces the terrifying moral confusion of this whole era.
Yeah, because instead of punishing him or demanding the money back, she blesses him in the name of the Lord.
Wait, really? She blesses the thief?
She does. And then she takes 200 of those recovered shekels to a local silversmith to have a graven image made.
Which is just, I mean, wow.
Yeah, she is actively breaking the core tenets of her own faith. These are direct violations of the Ten Commandments found in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. But she's doing it while simultaneously invoking the name of her God.
It's a total blending of authentic religion with pagan practices.
Syncretism.
Exactly. It's a textbook example of syncretism.
And Micah just leans into the chaos. He takes this silver idol, builds a house of gods, which is essentially a personal unholy shrine in his house, and installs his own son as his personal priest.
Which is another huge rule broken. That violates the rules laid out in the book of Numbers, chapter 3. Priests were strictly required to be descendants of Aaron.
Right. And then a young wandering Levite from Bethlehem shows up at Micah's door looking for a place to stay.
And the fact that the Levite is wandering is a massive red flag in the ancient context.
Oh, yeah. Levites were a designated priestly tribe. They were assigned to live in specific designated towns across Israel. They were supported by the community to maintain the spiritual health of the entire nation.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
So they were absolutely not supposed to be wandering mercenaries looking for a gig.
But Micah sees this wandering guy as a golden opportunity to legitimize his fake shrine. He basically offers this Levite 10 shekels of silver a year, plus food and clothes, to be his personal priest.
Yep.
And Micah actually says out loud, "Now I know that the Lord will be good to me since this Levite has become my priest."
It's unbelievable.
He genuinely believes he has just purchased a subscription to God's favor. It's so chaotic. But here's a fascinating part about how Matthewson teaches his audience to read this text. The biblical author never actually pauses the narrative to explicitly state, "By the way, stealing is a sin and making idols is bad, and Levites shouldn't wander."
Right. They don't spoon feed it. And Matthewson introduces a brilliant homiletical concept here to explain the biblical author's storytelling strategy. He compares the structure of the text to a highlights magazine for children.
Oh, like the ones in the pediatrician's waiting room with the hidden picture puzzles.
Exactly those. You turn to the page that says, "What's wrong with this picture?" And you have to actively scan the image to find, you know, the bicycle stuck in the branches of a tree or the banana resting on a windowsill.
Or a garden sprinkler going off in the middle of a living room.
Yes. The magazine doesn't provide a bulleted list of the errors. It trusts the reader's baseline understanding of reality enough for them to spot the absurdities themselves.
And that is exactly what the writer of Judges is doing.
Absolutely.
The author assumes the ancient reader knows the foundational laws of the Torah so intimately that when Micah's mom funds an idol or a Levite goes looking for a paycheck, the reader's internal alarm bells just ring constantly.
Yeah, it is a text absolutely covered in bicycles and trees.
But my question is, you know, why construct this story this way? Why wouldn't the author just spoon feed the moral to the reader to ensure literally no one misses the point?
Well, it comes down to the cognitive mechanics of how humans internalize truth. When a moral lesson is simply handed to an audience as a lecture, it often stays on a purely superficial intellectual level.
It's easily forgotten.
Right. But when an audience is forced to actively engage, to spot the discrepancies, to feel the wrongness of the situation themselves, they own that discovery. The tension makes the truth stick.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
What's fascinating here is how the biblical author provides a recurring, haunting backdrop for this entire puzzle. Throughout the book of Judges, we read this repeated phrase. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit.
Complete moral relativism.
Exactly.
Everyone becomes their own ultimate authority, which perfectly sets the stage for the heist, because now we have the tribe of Dan.
Right. Enter the Danites. Now, according to the earlier book of Joshua, the Danites had actually been allotted land in the southern part of the region. But settling that land required difficult work and, you know, conflict with the current inhabitants.
They didn't want the struggle.
No, they wanted a shortcut. So they send out 5 spies to scout out an easier, softer territory up in the north.
And the source material makes a really big point of calling this an unauthorized spy mission. It is not sanctioned by God, unlike the famous historical mission of Joshua and Caleb. It's a completely rogue, opportunistic operation.
Yep.
And on their way north, these 5 spies just happen to camp near Micah's house in the hill country.
Yeah, and the spies hear the young Levite speaking and actually recognize his voice. It was likely a distinct regional accent from his time in Bethlehem.
Oh, interesting.
So they ask him what he's doing up in Ephraim, and he explains his highly unofficial, totally cushy setup as Micah's personal hired gun priest.
So the spies seize the moment and ask the priest to basically inquire of God if their rogue mission is going to be successful.
Yeah.
And this corrupt Levite, without even a second of hesitation or actual spiritual discernment, just tells them, go in peace. Your journey has the Lord's approval.
He just rubber stamps their greed.
Exactly. Empowered by this fake blessing, the spies continue north and they discover a city called Laish.
And the description of Laish in the text is incredibly deliberate and just heartbreaking. The author emphasizes that the people of Laish were living in safety, at peace, secure, prosperous, and they lived a long way from their only allies, the Sidonians.
Wow.
Yeah. In the ancient Near Eastern context, attacking an unprovoked, peaceful city that posed absolutely no military threat wasn't just standard warfare. It was considered a heinous violation of the cosmic and social order.
They were the perfect, unsuspecting victims.
Tragically, yes.
So the spies run back to their tribe, report the vulnerability of Laish, and say, let's go take it. 600 heavily armed Danite warriors march out. They literally set up a military encampment called the Camp of Dan and begin marching toward Laish. But on the way, they detour back to Micah's house.
Right, because the spies remembered seeing the silver idol, the household gods, and an ephod.
Now, for clarity, what exactly was an ephod?
So an ephod was a highly sacred, intricately woven garment worn by the high priest. It contained a pouch used for discerning the will of God, essentially a direct line for divine answers. Having an ephod was a massive symbol of spiritual authority.
Ah, so the Danites decide they don't just want land. They want Micah's entire religious apparatus.
Yes, they want the whole package.
So the 600 armed men stand guard at the gate while the 5 spies walk right into the shrine and start bagging up all the sacred items. The Levite priest comes out, acting shocked, and asks what they are doing.
And their response is chilling. They basically tell him to shut up, be quiet, don't say a word, come with us. Isn't it better that you serve a tribe and clan in Israel as priest rather than just one man's household?
It's an extortion tactic wrapped in a job offer.
Totally. And the text explicitly notes that upon hearing this offer, the priest was immediately very pleased.
See, here's where it's really interesting, because the psychology of this moment bridges thousands of years. The Levite operates exactly like a cutthroat corporate middle manager.
Oh, completely.
He is the guy who claims absolute, unwavering loyalty to a small startup, right? Telling everyone they are tight-knit family. But the literal second, a massive Fortune 500 competitor walks into the lobby, flashes a VP title and a doubled salary. That same manager packs up the proprietary company's secrets in a cardboard box, walks out the door, and doesn't even leave a forwarding address.
Yep. The Levite has zero allegiance to God and zero allegiance to Micah.
None. His only loyalty is to his own upward mobility.
He is the ultimate spiritual opportunist. He helps the invading army pack up the stolen idols, strategically places his own family and his livestock at the front of the caravan to protect them from a rear attack, and just marches off with the thieves.
Heist goes off without a hitch. They secure the religious artifacts, they acquire a priest to legitimize their violence, and they march on. But as Dr. Matthewson transitions his analysis into the final act, he pivots from the mechanics of the story to the ultimate consequences of it.
Right.
Like, what is the actual price of this so-called success?
We finally witness the fallout of the idol factory. Micah realizes his shrine has been cleaned out, rallies his neighbors, and chases down the 600 armed Danites. He catches up to their rear guard, crying out that they have stolen his gods and his priest.
And the Danites turn around and basically laugh in his face. They issue a thinly veiled death threat, warning him to drop the issue before their men get angry and slaughter Micah and his entire family.
Yeah.
So Micah looks at the 600 armed soldiers, realizes he has absolutely no leverage, turns around and just walks home empty-handed.
And then the Danites proceed to Lachish. They brutally slaughter the peaceful, unsuspecting citizens, burn the entire city to the ground, rebuild it on the ashes, rename it Dan, and install Micah's stolen silver idol as their new religious center.
This is where Matthewson drops the absolute hammer on his audience. The text reveals the true identity of the corrupt, opportunistic young Levite priest who enabled all of this. His name is Jonathan. And he and his sons are direct descendants of Moses.
Which is just a staggering, horrifying revelation for an ancient reader. Moses was the great lawgiver. He went up Mount Sinai, spoke with God, and brought down the very commandments forbidding idolatry.
Right.
And now his own grandson or great-grandson is selling out that exact faith for a promotion, helping to establish a violent false religion in the north. It really demonstrates the terrifying speed of generational corruption.
The text adds one final devastating historical detail, too. It states that the tribe of Dan kept this fake idol set up in their city all the time the house of God was in Shiloh.
And Shiloh was the actual legitimate geographic location of the tabernacle, the portable earthly dwelling place of Yahweh. That single detail about Shiloh is the linchpin of Matthewson's entire homiletical argument.
Right. He uses it to show the cost.
Exactly. He uses this narrative to break down three concrete, unavoidable consequences of building your life around idols. Number one, you get nothing.
Right. When Micah is robbed, he asks the Danites, "What else do I have?"
And the chilling answer is zero.
Because when you build your entire identity on your career or your wealth or your social standing, and, you know, a market crash or a layoff takes it away, you are left completely empty.
Absolutely.
So what is the second consequence?
Number two, you end up in bondage. The text notes that these corrupt priests served in Dan until the time of the captivity of the land. Matthewson reminds his listeners that this refers to the eventual brutal conquest of the northern kingdom by the Assyrian Empire. Yeah. The Danites utilized ruthless, violent shortcuts to secure their freedom and prosperity. But those very methods established a culture that ultimately ended in their enslavement.
The shortcut became the chains.
Perfectly said.
And the third consequence.
Number three, and this is really the core tragedy, you miss out on the actual presence of God. By choosing the convenience of a plastic stolen religion in Dan, the tribe completely missed out on the true tabernacle located just a few miles away in Shiloh.
They were so close.
So close. Matthewson references Psalm 16, verse 11, which states that in God's presence is the fullness of joy. By settling for a fanageable substitute they could control, they missed the profound reality they were actually searching for.
I want to pivot back to the mechanics of how Matthewson delivers his devastating conclusion to an audience, because it really is a masterclass in tension.
Oh, totally.
Okay.
If we connect this to the bigger picture of public speaking, Matthewson utilizes a structural tactic he refers to as strategic delay.
Yes. When he initially read this story to his congregation, he read the verses about Micah losing everything, and he read the verses contrasting the idol in Dan with the tabernacle in Shiloh. But he didn't stop to explain their significance in the moment.
Right. He just let them hang there.
Exactly. He just planted those details in the listener's subconscious, let the violent narrative play out, and waited until the very final moments of his presentation to pull the emotional ripcord and explain what it all meant.
It forces the audience to hold the tension. He sets the hook in his introduction by asking a broad question, "What happens when you turn to God from idols?" And then he allows the chaotic actions of Micah and the Danites to do the heavy lifting before he circles back to resolve the tension through those strategically delayed verses.
I do have to challenge Matthewson on one piece of his preaching advice, though.
Oh, what's that?
Well, he acknowledges that in many religious traditions, the entire scripture passage is read aloud before the speaker even begins their presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that completely ruin this strategic delay? Like, if I read the text out loud at minute one, doesn't it spoil the ending of the story before I even start explaining it?
You know, it is a highly practical concern for public speakers, and Mathewson addresses it by comparing it to how human beings process narrative. Think about rewatching your favorite movie or rereading a novel you deeply love.
Okay.
When you watch that film for the fifth time, you know every single plot twist. You know exactly who betrays who. But that baseline knowledge does not insulate you from the emotional journey of the story.
You know, that is incredibly true. I know exactly how the vault is breached in Ocean's 11, but my heart rate still spikes every single time I watch the heist sequence.
Exactly. A well-constructed story, especially one that taps into the fundamental vulnerabilities of human nature, it retains its power, regardless of whether you know the historical outcome. The specific details of Shiloh and the Assyrian captivity might wash over a listener during an initial reading, but as the speaker meticulously guides the audience back through the psychology of the characters, the emotional weight of those delayed consequences lands with maximum impact.
We have covered massive ground today. We have analyzed how a masterful communicator can take a bizarre ancient historical record of cartel-style violence and use it to hold a mirror up to our modern obsessions.
Yeah, powerful stuff.
We've explored the quiet devastation of placing our ultimate trust in substitutes, and we have seen the brilliance of forcing an audience to search for the truth rather than just, you know, handing them a list of facts.
It really proves that the oldest texts we possess often contain the most urgent, sophisticated diagnoses of the modern human condition.
So, what does this all mean for you? I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. We talked earlier about the Highlights magazine, the childhood game of searching a crowded page for the things that don't belong, you know, the bicycles mm-hmm. stuck in the trees.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to look at your own life with that same ruthless, discerning eye, if you audited your daily routine, your calendar, your bank statements, your screen time, searching for what is out of proportion, what seemingly harmless good things would you realize you have actually built a shrine to?
It is an uncomfortable audit, but it is the exact introspection this 3,000-year-old story demands of us.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. Until next time, keep searching for the truth hidden in the narratives.